thing, and we blocked the entrance road so that tankers couldn't enter or leave, and we also mounted the main silo and dropped a 40-foot banner before locking onto the stairwell. The intention was to last as long as we could. We were successful on both counts. On the road blockade, 8 people locked on using arm tubes. They remained in place for an hour and a half before police malhandled the group and caused so much distress that the protesters were forced to break the link, and 5 out of the 8 were arrested. These heavy-handed tactics were picked up on camera. The police were completely unapologetic. There were serious breaches of health and safety, and on one occasion, blood was drawn from one of the protesters. On the stairwell, we managed to blockade for 5 hours, finishing at 1:45. There were 4 arrests after the D-locks were cut from the protesters. We felt forced to undergo this protest to draw attention to the severe impacts that large-scale agri-fuels are causing in a multitude of ways. In particular, we're facing the destruction of tropical rainforests and the risks that causes to climate as rainforests drive the rainfall cycle. And without predictable rainfall, we wouldn't be able to grow crops and we wouldn't be able to feed 6.5 billion people. So this is a very serious initial point. Then there's the issue of the additional contribution to climate change. All agri-fuels make climate change worse and add more in terms of emissions than the fossil fuels they replace. There is a major human rights abuse. Many corporations are now involved in land grabs, pushing small-scale farmers in the developing South off their land, and the land being acquired by big agribusiness to turn into large-scale monocultures for biofuels. Many of the major corporations are involved in this and turn a blind eye and even distance themselves from the problems that their own companies are causing. Another challenge is the increase in food prices that agri-fuels are causing. Because agri-fuels are linked to the price of crude oil, then inadvertently their food prices becomes linked as well. So food price tracks the price of crude oil through the medium of biofuels. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about soya or palm oil or rapeseed oil or sugar beet. Any of these products and others used as traditional foods that are now being used for agri-fuels are showing a very high increase in price, and that means that poor people are unable to afford these basic food staples. So much so that 37 countries have been protesting and rioting in this year alone. A sample taken from Greenergy's biofuel by Greenpeace assessed that 30% was coming from palm oil and 70% of the biofuel was soya. Now, both these agri-fuels are associated with massive tropical deforestation. In the case of palm oil, it's tropical peatland deforestation from Southeast Asia, and one study earlier this year showed that it was 840 times as damaging to climate as the fossil fuel diesel that it replaced. So far from being green, it actually added very significantly to greenhouse gas emissions. Soya bean oil also has a massive greenhouse gas contribution. And further, soya is very much associated with the destruction of rainforests in South America, the Amazon in particular, but also some of the delicate, fragile forests of Argentina, like the humid Yungas forest, which is now being decimated in order to provide soy products for the north. Jean Ziegler, a year ago, was the UN rapporteur on food, and he described biofuels as a crime against humanity. And he called for a 5-year moratorium. Many other NGOs have come forward and also calling for a 5-year moratorium. In fact, over 200 NGOs have come forward supporting this. We're also seeing moratoria called for by NGOs in the United States, by NGOs in Africa. Many NGOs in India and in South America are also calling for a halt to the targets set in European and the US, European countries and in the US, for biofuels. If I give you just one example, to fill a 4x4, one tank full, using bioethanol made from grain, that same grain would feed a person for a year. So corporations like Greenergy, Tesco and Harvest Energy that are all based at the West Thurrock site are quite simply profiteering out of the humanitarian disasters caused by food price rises and displacement of peoples from the land, the damage done to rainforest and from accelerated climate change. And their actions are hand in glove with government, who are choosing to turn a blind eye to the damage despite the very severe challenge that they're getting even from their own internal think tanks like the Environmental Audit Committee, who are coming out strongly saying that we must bring targets and incentives for agri-fuels to a halt. One thing I will end on is that the Renewable Transport Fuel Obligation, the piece of legislation that came in April this year, has called for 2.5% a 2.5% mix of agri-fuels in all fossil fuel, petrol and diesel. And the general public may not know it, but every time they fill up their vehicles, they are contributing to the damaging effects on climate, on rainforests and on human poverty. So we have to be very careful and start to recognize that as we remain unwitting contributors by virtue of the fact that we have to get around, even if we try to minimize our use of vehicles, we need to compensate for that. And one of the ways we can do it is by taking action ourselves, to join protest groups, to come out and show the local councils and governments that people are not going to accept this, to write to your MPs, to support email campaigns, and also to take part in direct action. We're asking for people to use innovative ways to make the government recognize that this is a very serious issue. If we don't, we'll face catastrophe as a result of agri-fuels, as the climate depends upon intact rainforests in order to retain climate stability. So during this week of Climate Camp, we are aiming to raise awareness of the significant contribution that agri-fuels are making to accelerating climate change. Thank you.
Hey, yo, Climate Camp Radio. It's Friday, because I've been losing track of the days. Friday, the 8th of the 8th. 08. 08, 08, 08. Hey! Right. We're going to interrupt the show, really, with just a very quick action update. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, we've just heard that 12 climate campers have just superglued themselves naked to the government department that is responsible for giving the go-ahead to Kings North.
Mind me asking which bits they superglued that required them to be naked?
I'm assuming it's the hands.
Okay, wicked. And so they're actually there right now.
They're there right now. They've just called me. They've said there's media there. It sounded crazy in the background.
Excellent. Whereabouts? What department?
It's in central London. It's BERD, Department for Business, Enterprise and Regulatory Reform.
Who ever heard of that before? That's a new one.
It used to be the DTI.
DTI. So if anyone's out in London, get down to the DTI. You see some naked people.
It's on Victoria Street.
Victoria Street. It's very central indeed. All right, well, if any of them are going to listen to this or are listening now, respected, loads of love. I hope it's not too windy or cold. And, grab some cot blankets. All right, so next up, we're going to have Adam doing a bit of a section for us. Hey, man.
Yeah, those of us who are not super glued naked to various ornaments and things are going to be taking advantage of the fact that there isn't a helicopter over our studio at the moment to have a brief discussion with a couple of people, participants in the camp who've come up from London. We're going to have a chat about the social effects of climate change, in particular, how climate change is related to other social movements and other political and economic processes. I'm here with Richard and with Robin. Say hello.
Hello. Hello.
Robin, let me start with you. You're involved in a lot of worker struggles and kind of migrant campaigns in London. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what exactly you've been up to in the camp so far?
Sure. I went to the camp for the first time last year at Heathrow just to kind of see what was going on. Like, over the last year, like, I've been involved in the workshops group putting together this kind of programme of workshops we've got this summer, which I think probably represents one of the biggest and most open and radical like forums for debate actually going on in this country that has brought together probably like a broader group of politics and like, you know, political backgrounds and movements together than I think most, you know, activist, you know, forums like going on at the minute. My main actual reason for getting involved in the climate camp was that, like, having seen the kind of potentials of what was going on here, the way consensus decision making's being developed, the way cooperative working's being developed, you know, the kind of understandings of like what's going on in reality with climate change, but actually like an absence of any kind of like perspective, like, well, perspective in practice of like social agency, how climate change relates to social movements. There's an understanding, but I didn't see that it had been translated into practice thus far as a climate camp movement.
Okay, so do you want to say a little bit more about that, actually, about the way climate change and maybe the environmentalist movement more broadly is related to other social movements, or the way it should be if it's not already?
Sure. I mean, for me, like, the starting point is understanding, like, what climate change means, you know, what it is as a process, where it comes from. Like, for me, it's like people talk here about, oh, this is the example. I mean, the best kind of language you get often is like, this is an example of like market failure, you know, but talking all these abstractions, you know, talking about a lot of talk about reducing CO2 emissions. One of the people that I think like that countered this most effectively was actually like a woman invited to speak on the opening night on like capitalism and climate change, who I think also like the struggle she's involved with also for me encapsulates the kind of like struggle that I think goes to the heart of like challenging like climate change. The woman was what called Clara, of the Nigerian background, from the Niger, like, you know, the oil regions, the Delta regions of Nigeria, who's now like working as a cleaner on the London Underground and is the chair of the RMT Cleaners Grade, who have recently been on strike for 3 days and will be going out on strike again like next week, I think, or the week after next. Now, Clara's story kind of like says a lot and says it all, you know, in that she's like, she was very much involved in the kind of oil politics in Nigeria, like the Kantarawiwa type politics, protesting against like corporate plunder, corporate pollution of like the region she's from. And, you know, and she came onto camp and like, you know, said how this very much reminds her of her kind of days of activism, only they would have had to have like held their meetings in like, you know, jungles rather than in kind of like fields like we've got, you know. But then how that kind of displacement of people, like, you know, that economic displacement, social displacement of people here, then forced into kind of some of the most exploitative jobs in the centre of London, and then have like the immigration controls there used to break that strike, you know, where you've had organisers and reps on the underground like sacked over their immigration status, where it's clearly being used as a means of victimising workers. But the point that she made, like, to tie it all up, that I think it like crystallises this, is that she's like, it's not about CO2 emissions. It's about all the social and lived realities of exploitation and oppression that need challenging, and need challenging by like a broad-based mass movement. And I think that's the message that I think like climate camp needs to understand. It's not just about CO2 emissions or any kind of abstractions. These are lived realities.
So was there any discussion in that particular workshop about the role of multinationals, for example, or the people who are actually kind of profiting from these processes, the people who are profiting from people being displaced and from resources being exploited? Was there any discussion about that?
There's always discussions. A high level of knowledge and depth knowledge, more knowledge on this camp in general that I would hold about the corporations, their profit turnovers, where their operations are, incredibly like detailed understanding of that. Very little engagement with those people who work to keep those industries going. Very little work in direct solidarity with those people who are affected by their operations, you know, but like as if that, like, we are the champions, we are the hope. And you hear that a lot. You hear that George Monbiot state it, people speak after speakers, like motivation. We are the heroes, we are the hope, we are the solution. I don't see that to be the case. For me, the real social forces lie with those oppressed, women who are oppressed, but people who are oppressed, whole continents that are oppressed by this system. And for me, centrally, like the workers who keep the system going of a day.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And how would you say what's the best way to kind of broaden the kind of environmentalist discourse that tends to be very, and it kind of is often very limited in its kind of scope? I mean, how do you breach these kind of divisions between environmental movements and workers' movements, for example?
I think it's probably just getting over like a bit of like amnesia, and that people would, this isn't the first time people would have heard this kind of analysis, you know. But like, I think people, like, one of the reasons this movement has grown so quickly in the way it has is that you've got a lot of like largely middle class people are quite excited about the prospect of being able to actually have a struggle in their own name, you know, like a struggle for, you know, like climate change, it affects everyone, it's a unifying thing, you know, we're all fighting climate change. So it's no longer, you know, like, oh, it's got to be the working class that leads this, or black people or women or peasants or indigenous people, it's all of us now, you know, so we can be the heroes.
So would you say that in some ways the kind of climate movement or the environmental movement has been a little bit depoliticized up until recently? I mean, in terms of lacking any kind of class or wider political analysis?
I think that's the case. So I think that, like, there's very little effort to, you know, put that analysis into practice in terms of the kind of actions and the kind of organisation, the kind of movements that are trying to be built here, you know. Like, concretely, productively, a group of activists within this have set up, like, Workers' Climate Action, which aims to kind of engage with, like, directly with workers in, like, frontline, like, energy industries. Like, we've been working around King's North to, like, we've got the support of the local Trades Council, who've been here, spoke on our plenaries, participated in our workshops. We've been organising daily visits to the power station in the morning and going to the pubs in Hoo where the workers go in the evenings. For me, what would stop King's North in a second is if the workers were convinced and walked out. That would be far more effective than people, fat people like me, trying to scale a fence.
And what's been the workers' response to the camp? Has it been largely positive, or have they had their own reservations, and what's been their take on it?
I think there's been a perception, and, like, you know, probably based on, like, to a large extent on reality, that, like, this movement does not take into account their interests, you know. Right. Doesn't give a damn if they're thrown on the scrap heap, you know, sees them as the enemy, in fact. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a strong undercurrent of that, you know, where there's no differentiation made between E.ON bosses, the government, and the workers in those industries. When pushed and put to them, people obviously do see the distinction, but in reality, in the kind of actions and the slogans that have been produced, there is no distinction made. Right. Or no effort to understand the different reality of workers there who might oppose climate change, and us who can come for a week and just get involved in some adventures.
Yeah. Very briefly, do you want to say something about your work in relation to migration struggles and the movement against kind of border regimes in London, and the relationship between that and climate change?
For sure. Like, I mean, like, we're seeing, like, I mean, we've just heard about the impact of biofuels and, like, the effects that are, like, widespread around, like, you know, Africa, Asia, like, all around the global south that are going to be hit hardest, you know, and ironically here in, like, northern communities in England that seem to be working class communities that seem to be hit here. Like, I'm of a Sri Lankan background, and, like, my family and, like, our ethnic community or whatever has been displaced by, like, the civil war that's been fought out in Sri Lanka for the last 30 years. It's exactly that territory that will, like, is under threat of floods, exactly that national, like, territory that's being fought over, that will be under the sea in, like, 20 years time potentially, if, like, the effects of climate change, like, carry on. Yet at the same time, and so people are being displaced massively by economic wars over fuel, like, over, you know, by ecological destruction, and yet we're creating all around America and around Europe, we're having fortresses built, you know, like, the government have put in law after law after law to drive like migrant workers underground. They're not necessarily stopping, like, migrant workers from coming in. In fact, there's increasing evidence to show that immigration controls stop the kind of free movement of people that would actually sort of, like, and actually serve to increase numbers of migrants here. But I think that's kind of, like, by the by. The real effect of it is to drive people underground, to stop people from organising and stop people fighting. That's the effect it's having on the underground. The government has introduced workplace raids and checks in September. They're going to even be asking landlords to do paper checks. So they're driving people out of work, and now driving people out of their homes come September.
Okay. On that note, I've got Richard here as well, who wanted to talk about government policy in relation to India, where he just spent 6 months making a film. So do you want to talk a little bit about where UK government aid has been going and what effects it's been creating in India?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the UK government gives £9 billion every year as development aid around the world. It does this through its Department for International Development, or DFID, you know, it's the acronym. India receives the most money out of any country in the world of this. In the last 5 years, they've given £1 billion to India. In the next 3 years, they'll give another £850 million. This money is, of course, given to help fight poverty worldwide. It's given, you know, to help the poor kind of get out of poverty. Now, one of the... I've got the nice glossy brochure here where they describe their work with loads of pictures of children like laughing and stuff.
Very nice.
One of their priorities in India, according to this, is promoting sustainable management of the Earth's resources. Environmental issues are always taken into consideration during the design and implementation of our programs and projects. I'll just give you one example of one of the projects we saw. It's called a Rural Livelihoods Project in Madhya Pradesh, which is one of the central states of India. It's a drought-prone area. There's a lack of food. I mean, people don't have enough food. People have been hit very badly by the recent increase in prices. Now, one of the livelihood, new kind of livelihood methods or new kind of livelihoods that's been encouraged through the project, which is funded by £60 million of the government's money, is jetrofa, so biofuels. I mean, you know, we've just heard about the impact of biofuels in general. Now, the project's pushing this as a way that people can get cash to buy more food. But of course, all the land now has biofuels on it, so there's no food to buy. Another example, in the northeastern state of Orissa, DFID basically wrote, it says help to wrote, but basically wrote the government's industrial policy. Now, since that policy, £75 billion of investments come into the country, most of which has come to mining. So coal mining, bauxite mining, and iron ore mining. So the result of this is massive displacement from the land as companies like Vedanta, POSCO are coming in. And of course, you know, a massive rise in emissions that's going to come from that.
Right.
But this is all being done in the name of development, in the name of helping the poor. I mean, you know, if you say you're helping the poor, you can pretty much get away with anything.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're running a bit short of time, but do you just want to say, as a final note, a little bit about the film you made on this subject where people might be able to find out a little bit more about the issue?
Right. Well, the film's called Dodgy Development. It's basically comprised of interviews with like, people who've been affected by these policies, these projects, by activists, various social people's movements over there, academics who... I mean, you know, we went around the country. There's a well of resentment and resistance against what DFID is doing over there, against these policies. As one example, this Rural Livelihoods Project, where they're pushing jetrofa, you know, two of the villagers in that region just said, no way, you know, you're not coming in. You're not coming in. We don't want you to do that. Now, of course, when that's written up in whatever the DFID or the government's brochures, the evaluation or whatever, it's described as a very successful project. X amount of people have benefited and all this. But, you know, the future results are going to be people just don't even have even less food than they do at the moment.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much for coming on. We're going to be going straight into a chat now by Radio Revolution, a group from London. Yeah, take it away.
Con Zapata vamos pa'l monte, con Zapata vamos pa'l monte, con Zapata vamos pa'l monte, con Zapata vamos pa'l monte. Comida a la lata, consumes y cosas que no necesitas, porque lo que a ti te sobra otra gente se lo quita. Cuánto tiempo va a tardar para que pongan un McDonald's en todo pinche lugar? Mientras tanto van talando el Amazonas, pues crece bien la soya y esta gente no controla.
Hello, welcome back to Climate Camp Radio. We've just got a quick announcement for a workshop in a little bit.
Yep. Hi campers, this is Chris Philpott and by Extra Man, we're putting on a green spirituality workshop in Space F at 2 o'clock this afternoon. It's an opportunity for those people interested in spirituality and green activism. Some people think it's a load of cobblers and some people think it's relevant to the movement. Whatever you think, come and see if green spirituality's friend or foe, waste of time, waste of space, or something that moves you and really gets your being going to tackle climate change together. Come along, you're all welcome, you all have your say. 2 to 4 in Space F this afternoon, Friday. Thank you.
Thank you, and also we have another announcement for early next week, the 12th of August. Ruth from Global Women's Strikes can tell you more.
Okay, on the 12th of August, there are going to be vigils all over the world, including one in London, for Levinsky Pierre-Antoine, who's a community activist from Haiti, who was kidnapped a year ago on that day. He spent a whole year missing, and nobody's had news of him, not his family or his community. He's a much-loved part of that community who has helped to defend them. Basically, there are UN troops in control in Haiti who are supposed to be keeping the peace. What they're not doing is finding Levinsky Pierre-Antoine. What they are doing is shooting, looting, raping, killing people in their beds. And just to give you a little bit of context, Haiti has a huge history of resistance. It was the first country to abolish slavery, setting an example for the whole hemisphere. And they were then made to pay reparations to the French for slave owners, because the slave owners had lost their property, the slaves. And the result of that incredible debt has been the most intense poverty, to the point now where people are actually eating mud cakes to survive, and their own agriculture, rice, has been destroyed by the US dumping their own rice. And their president, Ari Steed, their democratically elected president, Ari Steed, who actually demanded repayment of the money that had been stolen as compensation for the slave owners, he demanded that money back. He was taken out by a U.S. coup, not once, but twice. And the people who are resisting, who are trying to get their president back and trying to get food on their tables in food riots, are being labeled gangsters. The Lavalas movement is being labeled gangsters, while the Tonton Macoute are being put forward. Now, the vigil is from 1 to 2 at the Brazilian embassy near Marble Arch in London, moving on then to the U.S. embassy, where there'll be a silent vigil from 3 to 5. If you want more information, it's on www.levinsky.org. That's LOVINSKY, or from the Global Women's Strike. I know people will probably be recovering at that point. If you recovered enough, if you can make it, come. But if not, please tell your friends, because it's really important to defend people who have defended all of us.
Yeah, thanks, Ruth. That's at Tuesday the 12th of August, yeah, next week. And so now we have an interview with Kofi, who did a workshop on Black perspectives on climate change.
Right, I'm sitting here with Kofi and with Ronnie. Kofi, you're involved this morning in running a workshop on Black perspectives on climate change. Do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the things that we discussed?
Well, I actually facilitated a discussion, because I was very clear that I didn't want it to be a lecture. So, you know, it was more, you know, listening to what, you know, people had to say, as much as, you know, making some interjections, you know, to provoke and push forward, you know, the discussion. But the real thing was to encourage participants in the workshop to explore perspectives on the threat of climate chaos, you know, that come from outside what some will seem the predominant perspective, you know, in, you know, a place like this largely white, middle class, you know, do-gooders, you know, who, you know, are more concerned about what's going on in Europe, you know, and how, you know, climate change in the rest of the world is going to affect Europe, rather than, you know, looking at what is going on amongst other people. So, you know, it was quite interesting. First of all, the participants, you know, have come from a wide spectrum, you know, of backgrounds, and they were quite active, you know, in the discussion, and brought out many, many, you know, points with which actually I agreed with, but also issues for further dialogue. I think the key thing for me was to explore the historical, you know, perspective on this, the global historical, you know, perspective on the threat of climate, you know, chaos, and to, you know, clarify, you know, for people the fact that, you know, for particularly, you know, the vast majority of humanity that happens to be black, you know, the environmental crisis has been from long ago, has been from the era when it was like Europeans discovered Africa and the Americas, you know, and the fact that, you know, the casualties, you know, for example, in terms of what we call the Mangamizi, which is the African Holocaust of enslavement, you know, in the so-called slave raids, you know, not just people's lives were destroyed, you know, human beings are an important part of biodiversity, but also the environment was destroyed, you know, villages were burned, you know, plant life and, you know, animal life and other forms of life were also, you know, destroyed, you know, and we have the whole zoo thing, you know, which has been developed out of that. But also to look at the fact that for many people in the, you know, Americas, North, South, you know, and Central, you know, as well as in Australia, many people have been made to go extinct. Many nations, you know, were destroyed, you know, in the so-called European discovery, you know, of these places. And so to take us back to what those who faced the onslaught you know, of capital, you know, in the hands of the European ruling classes at the time as it invaded, you know, their environment and seized control of the environment violently, for them to understand that environmental crisis began from then, you know, and that's, you know, there are warnings that what you're doing in Africa and the Americas and Australia, you know, is like a boomerang that will get back at you, you know, that prophecy seems to be coming true right now, you know, and therefore we need to begin to tackle the environmental problem with a historical, correct historical perspective and tackle it at its root sources. And I think that message went down well. You know, people engaged in a discourse about chattel and colonial enslavement, you know, talked about the actual roots of the anti-slavery, you know, resistance movement, you know, and we had an interesting discussion about the movement, you know, here in Britain, you know, in the past as well as, you know, in the present, how that connects to the global. And of course, we discussed ways in which we can, you know, build, you know, upon the lessons from the past and the achievements, and also learn from the, you know, failures of the past, you know about the movements that existed both here and in other parts of the world, you know. So, and then we talked about, you know, grassroots connections, you know, that's actually challenged the attempts, particularly by the NGOs of the North, you know, to divert, you know, this relationship into one of clients and the patron client, you know, relationships, you know, and how by trying to create more horizontal relationships between campaigners at the grassroots levels who relate, you know, not just as individuals but also, you know, in terms of the social movements, you know, and collective organizations of resistance that they are building at the local level and connect that globally, you know, that we can begin to develop, you know, or return to the days of true solidarity, you know, that will strengthen the movement locally as well as, you know, globally.
Two of the things that came out of the discussion that I thought were very interesting were people highlighted the importance of land and land struggles and land reforms. And secondly, people were discussing various reasons why resistance movements in the global south have kind of maybe not always been given enough attention or have been ignored in kind of Western environmentalist movements. Do you want to say a little bit about those two issues?
Well, yes. I mean, the most visible harm that was done in particularly the history of European conquest, you know, domination of other lands, other peoples, is really the seizure of their land, you know, and the use of the land and its resources, you know, to enrich the ruling classes in Europe and impoverish, you know, the vast majority of humanity. And therefore, if we, you know, and that becomes one of the basic, you know, pillars, you know, of the present, you know, global capitalist, you know, system, which continues still to impoverish, you know, people. And that's, and also responsible for the kind of alienated lifestyles, which is causing further environmental, you know, destruction. And that if we are going to tackle, you know, the environmental crisis, you know, at its root, you know, it is important to understand the necessity of globalizing the struggles to reclaim land and take them from the enclosures into the back into the commons, and that this could be one main thread that unites, you know, the movements of environmental resistance, you know, globally. And it is, you know, in the same breath that we looked at how then people can supports each other in that process. The other issue that you mentioned, there needs to be proper dialogue, you know, and the correct horizontal relationships, you know, that puts various people in touch with each other. And the reasons why there seems to be little knowledge, you know, about particularly grass movements of resistance, you know, in places like Africa that are dealing with these kinds of issues, because mention was made of the examples of the Zapatistas and whether, you know, similar examples exist. I said, yes, I know the similar examples exist, you know, not as widely known, you know, as the Zapatistas, you know, but largely because also there are forces, you know, in the global north that are bent, you know, on, you know, dismissing and, you know, covering up, you know, those kinds of movements. And they do that through, you know, the kind of spurious partnerships, you know, they build with, you know, so-called organizations in these parts of the world that largely don't represent, you know, much more than some of the individuals, you know, that they make their main partner expats, you know, in these countries. But that's, you know, one is not to say that we don't need to connect expats in around these issues, but it's important that those relationships go beyond just individuals and small, you know, groups to actually embrace communities of resistance in their widest possible sense. And there was also, you know, issues around recognizing different forms, you know, of organization, different forms of struggle, you know, those that are open, semi-clandestine, clandestine. So, you know, that is, but in effect, the problem of the lack of visibility, grassroots movements of resistance like the Zapatistas in a place like Africa, largely is because the Western NGOs particularly, with Western governments, Western corporations, prefer to present, you know, people in Africa as just helpless, hopeless, incapable of doing anything for themselves, and all they need is the charity handout, the basket cases, the pornography of suffering where they can't do anything about, you know, and we need to, you know, rescue them. It's all the, you know, the colonial burden all over again. And that is why the challenge is on, you know, those who are keen on developing grassroots solidarity to go out of their way to look for the work that those organizations are doing on the ground, you know, go beyond the internet, because most of these, you know, grassroots forces don't have telephones, let alone, you know, internet connections. The little resources they have cannot afford those kinds of resources. And the sharing of resources, including the sharing of knowledge, you know, as we build those relationships, will help to address this problem. I mean, Ronnie, who has been in Ghana, you know, knows quite a lot about this, and I think it would be useful for him to comment.
Yeah, Ronnie, you spent about 3 years in Ghana. Do you want to tell us a little bit, just very briefly, about some of the things that you learned while you were out there and what you were doing?
Yeah, I spent about 3 years in Ghana. I came there as a tourist with a friend of mine, which I met in Germany. He's a Ghanaian himself. And, well, I came to Ghana first, and I liked the country, and I stayed. My former profession, I was a fashion designer, and being in Ghana, I saw various issues on the ground, and at some point I decided to leave that and do something for my life which I believe is more worthwhile. So I started working with a local NGO there, and I saw issues on the ground. I saw poverty, at the same time I saw the riches of the country. I saw fishermen struggling to get fish in their nets, whereby a lot of rubbish in their nets, whereby big trawlers screaming on the sea floor to all kinds of fish, so the local fishermen, they don't catch anything anymore. What else did I see? Oh yeah, the NGOs work. All the big NGOs have almost visit all of their offices, and they have very nice offices, but I haven't seen what they are actually doing on the ground. People are willing. I wasn't a lot around young people, and young people are willing to do things and to change things, but they need empowerment, they need structures, they need facilities.
Yeah, just around that, do you want to tell us something a little bit also about some of the things you're doing in London, because you're based in South London now, I think, and I think some of the work you're involved in is working with young black people, especially in London. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, coming back from Ghana, I came to London, and we started the same organization here in London, and our work with young people is much about education and empowerment. We want to get the young people involved in doing things for themselves, not adults speaking for them, but they taking the initiative under the guidance of the elders. And, well, I think Kofi can also talk a bit more about what we are planning for the future.
Well, I think Ronnie has brought into youth work, particularly in London, you know, the perspective of a European youth activist who's gone onto the ground and seen what ordinary people are trying to do, particularly young people, for themselves, and also the kind of support that they need, you know, from abroad, you know, to strengthen their own self-empowerment. And that is what he's been trying to do. And it is about, one, raising awareness amongst young people in Britain, you know, in terms of the actual conditions and the aspirations of young people in Africa, which, you know, it's almost like this, right? And also to build direct grassroots to grassroots connections, campaign initiatives. And out of those efforts that Ronnie and the Youth Concern Global Network have been trying to promote, you know, in the UK, they build partnerships with the Edinkafo Pan-African Youth and Students Internationalist Link, which also, you know, has its representations, you know, in Ghana. You know, they've been able to build relations with the NUS Black Students Campaign, and particularly with the African Caribbean Youth and Student Action, you know, that is developing as a particular pressure group, you know, within the NUS Black Students Campaign. The Dinkafo PESIL and the YCGN have teamed together to launch the Planet Repairs Youth Positive Action Campaign, you know, which is to encourage young people all over the world, you know, to connect with each other in terms of the local struggles, you know, that are environmental struggles that they are waging, and to develop the global dimensions, you know, of that work, so that they can support each other. And it's quite fascinating in terms of the educational, the advocacy, you know, and the campaigning activities that Ronnie, you know, is encouraging, you know, young people, particularly in London, to develop.
Have you got any final comments about your experiences this week, what you've learned at the climate camp?
Well, this is my very first climate camp, and, you know, actually I am hugely inspired by the quality, you know, of participation. It is mind-blowing, you know, to see how particularly young people, you know, in Britain are trying to stop this mad rush, you know, towards the destruction of the planet by trying to return to ways of life that are more in tune, you know, with nature. And I just wish, you know, and I've been saying this, I just wish I could have the eyes of all the young people of Africa on this climate camp today. Because we have a situation where, you know, the global elites, you know, with their corporations and particularly powerful propaganda tools, including the media, are trying to drive young people to embrace this consumerist lifestyle, you know, this the Hollywood fantasies, you know, and the very ways of life that have proved so destructive in Europe and North America, you know, particularly with devastating consequences on people across the world. But young people, this is the propaganda still being sold to young people. And I wish African youth particularly would have their eyes on this climate camp to see that a lot of what they now have, which they are being pushed to see as not good enough, is really what youth in Europe now see as what they aspire to, now see as the salvation of the entire planet. And I really believe that the pre-pack idea of having in 2010, you know, in Ghana, a similar climate, you know, camp in similar surroundings would happen by participants in my workshop and others in this climate camp working together with their colleagues, you know, in Ghana and other parts of Africa and the world to make this happen. Because that is, for me, that would be it. Because for me, it's not about having nice discussions, you know, around these issues. It's about moving on to connect and take things forward so that we can, you know, really save humanity.
Climate protesters have carried out a series of coordinated raids on sites across the southeast.
At the climate camp in Hu, residents get used to the disruption and their new neighbours.
Tonight, one of Britain's leading environmental activists says he no longer cares whether nuclear power is in our future.
Welcome to the Climate Camp Media Review for Thursday, the 7th of August. In this feature for Climate Camp Radio, we look at how the camp and its related actions have been covered in the mainstream media. Today we will be looking at George Monbiot's surprising announcement about nuclear power, some coverage from this morning's actions, and the way in which the media have been duplicating more of the lies and spin from Kent Police. Kent Online, although a small and local media outlet, have been doing pretty good coverage of the camp. Yesterday, they were the first to publish a video of police using excessive force yesterday during stop and searches. The footage is now available on UK in the media. So how about the actions this morning then? An article in The Guardian about the action at the biofuels depot in Thurrock, Essex. Jenny Percival writes about the blockade and underlying issues.
The climate activists at Vopak were targeting biofuels, petrol or diesel made from plant materials. Biofuels were originally seen as a greener alternative to fossil fuels, but have been shown to cause deforestation and contribute to food price rises as land use is switched to growing fuel crops such as palm oil and maize. The protesters said companies such as Greenergy and Tesco, which use the depot for biofuel supplies, were causing food price rises, world hunger, ecosystem destruction and accelerated climate change.
The BBC ran a story outlining all the actions at the biofuels depot in Essex, at Gatwick Airport and the mass die-in at the head offices of the Royal Bank of Scotland in London. It didn't go into any of the issues though, and they deemed it necessary to repeat the stories about the raids, standoff and stop and searches. They did however report that the total number of people arrested is now 22. Local TV and radio ran news items about the actions across the morning, although mainly about the action at the biofuels depot. Meridian News spoke of a series of coordinated raids on site across the southeast. It's been said that Channel 4 News will be featuring a news item about the action tonight. Johan Hari posted a short item about the Royal Bank of Scotland to his blog on the Independent website, in which he explains how the bank sells itself as a green bank, but is actually responsible for emitting more greenhouse gases than the whole of Scotland put together. This is an extract of what he wrote.
In 2007, the Royal Bank of Scotland loaned $15.9 billion to companies engaged in digging or burning coal, the worst record in Europe. Yet the bank distributes leaflets claiming it has a strong environmental record. How can it get away with this? The Royal Bank of Scotland's leaflet is based on two claims. Firstly, they point out that their individual branches have a good record on recycling. True enough, but the Independent Carbon Disclosure Project calculates that 99% of the carbon footprint of large banks comes from funding oil and coal extraction, and this is where the Royal Bank of Scotland is appalling. Isn't it a teeny bit dishonest to brag you are good at the other 1%?
Okay, so we're keeping a close eye on the spin and manipulative PR that continues to come from Kent Police's press office. We're now going to look at their continued efforts to show the media and the public that they are the ones taking the initiative in improving the relationship with the climate camp residents.
Well, it seems as if Assistant Chief Constable Gary Bowtridge's bid for an OBS, that's Order of the Brown Shirt, might be backfiring on him. At about the time that a police liaison rep was saying this on the camp radio last night.
So finally now we've asked them yet again for a clear proposal. What do you actually want to do on site? Who do you want on site? How do you want it to be done? And then maybe we can actually start to get somewhere. But as yet, we're still waiting for that information. And as yet, we still haven't got a clue what these police want to actually do.
A press release appeared on the Kent Police website entitled Police Talk with Climate Camp Members to Resolve Issues. It claimed that talks with members of the camp's liaison group at High Holstow Village Hall had taken place. Assistant Chief Constable Gary Bowtridge said after the meeting, "We have worked hard to maintain dialogue with the organisers of the camp since they announced their intention to stage the event, and we'll keep talking. The community residents of the camp have told us how they would like us to police them. We are considering their views and we will respond accordingly to move relationships forward. I would hope that we can continue to work with the organisers to police the site in a way that satisfies both ourselves and the people attending." ACC Bowtridge added, "Our message remains very clear. We will police the event proportionately so that the people attending it can protest lawfully. We know the vast majority of those on the site are responsible and law-abiding, and we want to be able to provide a service to them. Shortly thereafter, in customary journalist style, Sky News announced an icy relations thaw at climate camp, while the BBC ran most of the police press release with a few rebuttals from the camp. It might be an indie media newswire commentator who summed up how splendidly ACC Boatridge's policing is going when they thanked him for radicalising a whole generation.
Right. This is the end of today's media review. A shout out again to Doug for providing us with most of the media coverage and the extract from the Guardian article, and FTP for the piece about police spin. Please note that all the reports and articles were edited down. We'll leave you with an extract from George Monbiot's visit to the Newsnight studio, where he explains how he's changed his mind on nuclear. So for now, adios and ciao ciao.
Going nuclear, will it tear the green movement apart? If the Green Movement were a religion, and sometimes its more dogmatic adherents make it sound as if it is, then being anti-nuclear would be one of the Ten Commandments. But today, in an article largely devoted to encouraging protests against a new coal-fired power station planned for Kent, campaigner George Monbiot declared that the fight against coal is so important, the question of nuclear no longer much matters to him.
I have now reached the point at which I no longer care whether or not the answer is nuclear. Let it happen. We can no longer afford any rigid principle but one, that the harm done to people living now and in the future must be minimised by the most effective means, whatever they might be.
You've come from a camp demonstrating against a coal-fired power station. Are you now saying that if this were a nuclear power station, you wouldn't bother with a protest?
I don't think I would. It's not, as you say, that I've become an enthusiast, and I think there need to be extremely strict conditions before we even consider nuclear power, like whole system costing of the carbon emissions, like knowing where the waste is going to go and how it's going to be disposed of, knowing how much it's going to cost, who's going to carry those costs, making sure that there's a legal obligation, that there is no transfer of civil nuclear materials to military purposes.
But with those caveats, you are open-minded to the question because you see coal as, because of the CO2 emissions, such a problem.
The approach I favour is of the kind that they're using in California, where they say, we set a maximum level of carbon emissions per megawatt hour of electricity generation, and that should be a very, very low maximum indeed, 80 kilograms per megawatt hour, 50 even, which means that only a very small number of technologies could qualify. If nuclear met all those very stringent conditions, I've reached the point where I don't care anymore. What I want to do is to stop runaway climate change, to stop 2 degrees of warming. Nothing else matters nearly as much as that.
Am I back? Yeah. Okay. Cool. Okay. Well, welcome back. This is Neil. I'm here with Niall from Shell to Sea and the Rossport Solidarity Camp, which is located in Rossport in Mayo in the west coast of Ireland. And we're here to talk about the Shell to Sea campaign. First of all, it's been quite a long-running campaign. The Shell to Sea campaign got off the ground at the June Bank Holiday in 2005 with the gathering down there in Erris in Mayo. And I was wondering, Niall, could you just fill us in on like a brief sort of timeline from sort of 2005 to nowish, I guess, yeah? What's happened?
Yeah, 2005 was the time when the Shell to Sea campaign became a national campaign and even an international campaign. Up to then, it had really dates back to the year 2000 when Shell proposed this gas refinery onshore up in Erris, County Mayo, attached to an onshore gas pipeline for 10 kilometres and then an offshore pipeline. So since 2000, really, local people have been fighting this campaign through the usual channels, opposing, planning, engaging with the state, etc. But they were always let down, and they found that their local politicians, politicians in central government, all the institutions of the state and even the courts really ignored the plight of local people who were withdrawing their consent to this project. And in 2005 then, a national gathering was held in Rossport, which invited campaigners from all around the country and came up. And I was part of that and got involved then. And then shortly after that, five men called the Rossport Five were put to jail for ignoring an injunction that had been granted to Shell, instructing these men to allow Shell onto their own private land. And they said no. And they refused to obey that injunction. They went to jail for 3 months. And that was the start of a national campaign. And since then, it has really developed as a national and international campaign, in working closely with the local community. And we set up our Rossport Solidarity Camp in 2005 on the land of one of the Rossport Five. And we maintained that camp until 2007. Until we were successfully evicted by the local county council at the behest of Shell. And in my own opinion, I think we could have appealed that decision, but decisions were made anyway that we wouldn't, that we would obey that, and we took down the camp. But we still have the Rossport Solidarity House, which is a place for people to come from around the country and internationally to come and support the campaign. In 2005, the Corrib Gas project was shut down by the local community and national campaigners, who blockaded the site successfully for 18 months and stopped all work on the Corrib Gas project. And the picket was broken then. That picket was broken in 2006 by the Irish police force on Garda Síochána, who came in their hundreds and broke the picket with force and violence and picked on men, women and children, old and young. Since then we have been struggling, let's say, because the campaign has diminished somewhat, and but we fight on.
Okay, and it's quite a broad-based campaign, and I'm just wondering what sort of tactics have been used throughout the 3 years. Has it been direct action or lobbying or a mixture of both? Or?
We've done everything. You know, we've had different groups around the country. We've been very strong on media. We've had a lot of public talks around the country where we invite local speakers to come down. We do stalls in local towns and cities around the country. And also then we organise days of action up in Mayo for people to come up for non-violent direct action against this project. Yeah. And we believe in that. This campaign has always, the Shell to Sea campaign has been a campaign of civil disobedience. We say no to this project. And if the state want to push it through by force, we say no, and we will oppose that.
Okay. There's been quite a lull in activity in the campaign since spring of this year.
Yeah.
And it's kind of been regenerated again. I don't know, could you perhaps explain why the lull and why the renewed energy is?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. I mean, the refinery is going ahead at Ballinaboy because the cops have effectively kicked people off the roads, and they are going ahead building that refinery, but they've yet to build a pipeline, and we still think we can defend against that. But what happened was in the spring, because people are fearful again of confrontation with regard to opposing the fresh pipeline, some of the local people and some of the high-profile local campaigners offered a fresh compromise to Shell and said, look, would you consider putting your onshore refinery further up the coast at a coastal location, negating the need for an onshore pipeline? And this was a proposal that came from some members of the Shell to Sea campaign, essentially a fresh proposal and a split in the campaign. And so this has created a few problems for us because, as I say, it's a split. But and in terms of our own Shell to Sea aims and objectives, we still say that Shell should put their refinery offshore on a sea-based platform, which was recommended by a senior inspector with the planning board in Ireland, who said the project as currently proposed is the wrong project in the wrong place. But yet, so these present problems, and I think it's understandable for a campaign that's been going on for 8 years altogether that, you know, human nature being what it is, that it's not always easy to be very, very strong. So we'll press on anyway, and we're reorganising Shell to Sea now, and we're going to put some fresh energy in and invite people back to support the campaign.
Okay, so in terms of regenerating, what have you got coming up?
Well, this weekend in Ireland, in Mayo, there's a Reclaim the Beach gathering, which is happening on the beach at Glengad, where Shell are constructing a landfall, where all members of the community are coming, because whatever about the split, we all reject the project as currently proposed, and there's a gathering on the beach in Mayo. Okay. And on Saturday the 30th of August, or thereabouts, towards the end of August, we're having a bigger camp gathering in Mayo. So I'd invite people who are interested in the Shell to Sea campaign to stay close to the websites, which are shelltosea.com, or you can Google Rossport Solidarity Camp, and all the contact details for Shell to Sea are there, and we'll be having a bigger camp gathering, and all are welcome towards the end of August, possibly Saturday the 30th of August. And just in the immediate future, here at the Climate Camp, we're having a film night tonight at 7 o'clock. The Bicycology crew in the Bicycology tent at the Climate Camp are showing some of our short films, Policing the Pollution by Oscar Beard, The Siege of McGrath's Pier, a short film about Shell's cops and Garda Síochána, and also the recent Goldman Environmental Award, which was awarded to one of the Rossport Five, Willie Corduff, who was awarded this award last year for his fight against Shell. So we'll be showing some of those movies tonight, and here at the Climate Camp at 7 o'clock.
It's in the Bicycology tent at 7 o'clock.
Yes.
They should be listening to the radio, but I guess they can go watch the film. All right, okay. Okay. Well, thanks very much. I'm sorry we're short on time, unfortunately, Niall. So if you go along and watch the films, you'll see that this is a pretty disastrous project for the local community. There's a lot of social impact. There's it's a fishing community. There's schools nearby. There's all sorts of impact that this refinery is going to have. So you can go along and find out more information at this film, or go to Ireland, even better. And one more thing, Niall.
Yes, I just want to say a sincere thanks to all our British friends and our international friends who have come to stay at the camp and given us so much support. So thank you to you all, and I hope to see you soon in Mayo again.
Okay, cool. All right, thank you very much, Niall. Talk to you later. Next we have a poem which it was recorded in Mayo, and it's just... Here we go.
Hey, and we're back live from Climate Camp, and we've just got a couple of announcements to make. There's a Fit Shop workshop meeting thingy happening at 6:30 in Tent D, so go check that out. And if you are out in the field and you would like to send us some audio, very important for tomorrow, there is a number you can call. That is 020-704-33783, and it's menu number 6. And basically, you just leave a message, and we'll get the audio file, and we can use it for shows in the future. This radio show is brought to you by a conglomeration of radio stations around the UK, and those being Dissident Island, Rise Up, Flash Radio, and PlentyFact.net. And we're now going to go into an interview with Lonnie, who did a workshop on accessibility and sustainability.
My name's Lonnie Parker. I come from North London, and I'm a wheelchair user. Yesterday, lunchtime, we had a meeting on disability and sustainability in the Yorkshire kitchen. I called the meeting to try and address some of the issues, not only at camp, but some wider issues around how to include disabled people in the movement, and thinking about disability when we're thinking about climate change. Because not only in the UK, but internationally, disabled people are going to be hit harshly by climate change, and there's lots of issues around how we integrate inclusion with the concepts of sustainability. And so I wanted to get people together to start talking about that. First we talked about how camp was going in terms of accessibility, and there was a few issues around the toilets, and the fact that we haven't got enough boards and things like that. And also it was kind of felt that it's a bit of a peripheral issue, and so that's why I wanted to really call the meeting to see how we could make it a more central, because I think if we're going to make it an inclusive mass movement, we really need to think about disability issues, not only physical access, but also stuff around mental health issues, people with neurological differences, and how that sort of thing affects people. Particularly, so we talked a lot about the camp and how if there was another climate camp, maybe people want to think more about the issues and start a working group, and have it a more of a central issue within the camp. And then we also talked a little bit about the general thing, the general sort of how we can push this forward and link the two, because they are very linked. And one of the things that came up is that when thinking about sustainability, we're often thinking about reducing resources, use of resources and self-sufficiency and things like that. And perhaps that in and of itself kind of excludes a lot of disabled people. One, because it tends to be quite an academic argument, and that feels not particularly relevant to a lot of people, but also that some people do need a lot more or different types of resources or more resources than other people, and for some people being self-sufficient in itself doesn't work or isn't a concept that is relevant to their lives. And so, for example, there was so that whole thing about the austerity, going back to being self-sufficient, is actually quite exclusive, and we need to think about that issue.
Yeah, like it's sort of reinforcing a survival of the fittest and